Well, it's good to be with y'all this evening. Very excited. This song? Okay. All right, we're good. Sweet. Okay. All right. So, I was, as soon as I got here, January 11th, we had already done some sign-up sheets and stuff, and I was like, okay, I got February 1st. How about that? First day of the month, I've got it. And then I realized there was a bunch of stuff that happened before that, and so it's been kind of crazy, but that's okay. So it's very exciting to be with y'all this evening. Tonight we're going to be in Exodus chapter 2 and chapter 3. Most of our lesson will be in chapter 3, so you can kind of just put your finger there. Before we get started, I'm sure you guys know what these look like. These are the new seven wonders of the world. About 2,000 years ago, there used to be seven previous wonders of the world, but in the year 2000, some people from like a foundation from Switzerland had decided that the original seven wonders of the world were technically outdated because either everything rotted out of existence, or it was destroyed a couple thousand years later. And so in 2000, they put out this poll to have these new seven wonders of the world. And after 7 years of text messages, emails, internet surveys, this foundation finally concluded what the seven wonders of the world were. And they are the Taj Mahal, the Colosseum, Christ the Redeemer, Machu Picchu, Petra in Jordan, the Chichen Itza, and the Great Wall of China. However, out of the original seven wonders, since these are the new, the original seven wonders, there was only one that still existed today, and that is the Pyramids of Giza. And the Pyramids of Giza were actually kind of considered an honorary member of these seven wonders. Why I want to talk about the Pyramids of Giza is we see so many pictures of the Pyramids of Giza, and usually people take them from a distance, and they don't seem to look very big, but as you can see in this next picture, it's absolutely massive. I mean, and it's just amazing to see how big they are. I mean, you see this person in the blue shirt here. I mean, he's just sitting on a rock, and it's, you know, levels above him. It's about most of those pyramids are about 700 feet wide and about 450 feet tall. Truly an amazing wonder. And I think about the qualities that in this survey that this foundation had made for the seven wonders of the world, it had to consist of three qualities. It had to be man-made. It had to symbolize a chapter of history, and it had to give a sense. It had to pass the eye test, so to speak. It had to have this sense of wow, and I mean that already speaks for itself. And so. As I was thinking about the lesson that I wanted to prepare tonight, I didn't do it tonight. I didn't prepare it today. But a few days beforehand, as I was thinking about the lesson that I wanted to prepare, I thought about the seven wonders of the world, and I thought about, well, how much more awesome and how much more great is our God? And so... that's why we're going to be in Exodus chapter 3 tonight, is because we're going to look at the qualities of an awesome God. And so in chapter 3, of course, most of us know this story, and that is the burning bush. We know that story, but beforehand, we're going to be reading chapter 2 and verse 23 through 25 because it helps set the scene and set the stage for what Moses is fixing to get into and what God is fixing to get into as well. We know that Moses is a shepherd at this time. He is tending sheep just before, right as the situation is going on. We have in chapter 2 really a short biography of Moses up until the burning bush. We know that he was saved by Pharaoh's daughter after being put on the Nile River to keep away from people that were trying to kill Hebrew children, specifically the men. Then he grew up in royalty and then had a negative reputation with killing an Egyptian, causing him to flee. And then he later saves his family, saves his future wife's family, and becomes a part of their family and ultimately ends up a shepherd. And so these next three verses here are going to set the scene of what Egypt and what the nation of Israel looks like during the time of Moses. It says in verse 23, "During those many days, the king of Egypt died." So the original person who wanted all of these Hebrew children, specifically the males, killed, he has died. "And the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew." So again, right before we get to chapter 3, the author wants the people of Israel, or the author writes that the people of Israel, they are struggling right now. There's terrible slavery going on at this time. And so they have all this punishment, all this oppression going on, and the only thing that they can do is cry out for help. And luckily, we have a God that will save them in the meantime. But we think about these Israelites and the slavery and the oppression that we went to, that we see here. It makes me think that they probably feel as though God had abandoned them up to this point, leaving them to rot and not keeping his promise, which is a promise of deliverance. For us, us that are reading the text, we know that they have been in this position for 400 years. You know, the Israelites, they don't know this at this time. They're not reading what we're reading right now. You know, they are living this out as we're reading it. I want us to kind of think about that at this time, being under all of this oppression, it was really, really hard for them, maybe even to trust in God, maybe even to believe in God. And so Egypt had this big, for them to be such a big nation at the time, they had all these other gods that they worshipped. Israel needed help because they didn't know who to turn to. So a lot of people may have potentially turned to these lowercase g gods. I believe Marty said that last week, so I'm going to give him credit for that. They had turned to these gods, and we'll look in this next slide at who those gods were. John Mark Comer, who's a famous former pastor and a famous author to this day, he wrote a book called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. He also wrote a book called God Has a Name. And so he talked about in this book, God Has a Name, he talked about how people are hardwired for worship. He talked about how people are drawn to what they pay attention to. The nation of Israel, they lived at a time where there was oppression. And so maybe some of them probably looked for a way out. And so they turned to these lowercase g gods. They started paying attention. Some of them probably paid attention to these lowercase g gods, and they only gave short gratification and momentary pleasure at those times. Examples of those gods were Hapi, and I'm probably going to butcher these pronunciations, so I apologize for that. But there's the god Hapi, which is the god of the flooding of the Nile. And then we have the next one, who is Heket, who's the god over regeneration, rebirth, and fertility. And obviously, you see here, it looks like a frog. And we see throughout the 10 plagues that God was not only saving the people of Israel, but he was also attacking Egypt's identity, which was to turn to these other gods. And so, you know, obviously this had to deal with the plague of the frogs. And then here we have Geb, who was the god of the earth, the god of fertility. And then we have Shu, and then we have Hathor. Shu was the god of the air and the sky. And then Hathor was the god of fertility, love, and the sky, and it was portrayed as a cow, which we see in Exodus, where God attacks the livestock of Egypt, which was to go against this god, Hathor. You know, and again, going back to this point of people being hardwired for worship, that we become drawn to what we pay attention to. And for Egypt, they had focused their attention on the nature going on in this world, their livestock and their resources, rather than the God who had created all things. You know, after Joseph died, we see that that the Pharaoh of Egypt, he had turned away from God. He did not know Joseph, and that was passed down later as well. And so now we get to Exodus chapter 3. We get to Exodus chapter 3, and we're going to be talking about a God that appears to Moses, and we will find out his identity later in verse 14. But we read here that, "Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, 'I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned.' When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, 'Moses, Moses.' And he said, 'Here I am.' Then he said, 'Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground.' And he said, 'I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.' And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God." Obviously, AI did a pretty good job making this picture. I'm not sure how equivalent it was to actually what had happened, but it was truly a sight to see, a bush that was burning, but yet it was not consumed. Almost like a phenomenon. If you have ever heard of a phenomenon, it's something that's in nature that is a very rare occurrence. There's something called nacreous clouds, which are extremely rare. They only occur at temperatures below negative 86 degrees Celsius. Of course, that's in the stratosphere, so I don't think it happens on Earth, but we can see it in the sky. It's truly a remarkable image, and it only occurs mostly in the polar region, so us folk from Oklahoma wouldn't even get a chance to see it unless we went to the North Pole or Antarctica or somewhere. However, I was looking at a stat how often the nacreous clouds occur, and it was, they said it was actually a little bit more common than I had realized. And It's crazy that something like that, where the temperature has to be negative 86 degrees Celsius, which is who knows how much in Fahrenheit, you know, that is more common than a burning bush that was not consumed. I mean, that's truly amazing that God chose to use something for someone so big and so mighty and so awesome. He used something like just a normal bush to appear to Moses, which shows you how different God was. He wasn't, yes, he is amazing, he is big and mighty, but he also appears any way that he wants to. He is in control of that situation. And it's just so amazing to think about Moses being in the presence of something as awesome as that. But you know, he gets a glimpse of this power when God speaks to him. He says, "Do not come near, take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." And then Moses reveals his God reveals his identity to Moses, saying who he is. And you know, it makes Moses afraid. It makes him actually very fearful of who God is, because, you know, Jethro, being a priest, he probably has heard and probably knows of God, but to actually be in the presence of God is pretty overwhelming. And so he's feeling both reverence and fear as he takes his sandals off and as he is hiding his face, because he is in the midst of a God that is just so much unlike anything else that we have ever seen. In verses 7 through 15, it says, "Then the Lord said, 'I have surely seen the affliction of my people who were in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings. And I have heard their... And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place out of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt.' But Moses said to God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?' He said, 'But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain.' Then Moses said to God, 'If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them?' God said to Moses, 'I am who I am.' And he said, 'Say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you.'" God here is giving Moses the ultimate task. And that task is to go to Pharaoh and let Israel go. He calls him to be a leader, something that Moses may have been a part of in royalty at some point, but you know, he had after he had killed the Egyptian, he had fled, probably avoiding responsibility, avoiding the consequences of his actions. Yet he did rescue his future wife's family, but you know, he is living a quiet life, and God tells him to do something really big, and it's something that is out of his comfort zone. And so Israel, when I think about this, Israel doesn't know this God because it's not revealed who he is until verse 14, and that is, "I am who I am." And of course, that word, the word in the Hebrew is Yahweh, and we'll talk about that word a little bit later in our lesson. But, you know, Moses, comes to him and he asks if Israel asks me, who is this God? You know, they ask, what is his name? He asks, what shall I say to them? You know, they don't know this God because he is unlike any other God. You know, all of these other gods seem to be man-made images and represent things that really don't matter in the long run. You know, of course, they want the Egyptians want to have life. You know, they want to have their livestock and everything of theirs to be plentiful. But, however, you know, it doesn't mean anything in the long run because they weren't giving the glory and the honor to God. And so Moses, even he is questioning who he is, but yet he gets to be a part of the big picture in God's plan, which I'm sure was absolutely horrifying at this time. You know, later, and we'll talk about it here, you know, Yahweh and God, who is speaking to Moses, he has this task for him. He calls Moses, who is probably more on the quiet side, someone that is uncomfortable with maybe public speaking, as we see here, or whatever it is, some kind of leadership. You know, Moses is uncomfortable with that. You know, God still ultimately ends up using him for his glory. And because of that, you know, God can use each and every one of us according to his purpose. You know, someone that is able to, a God that is able to grab a shepherd and use him for God's glory, that is the only God that is deserving of worship. And so when I think about these verses and God revealing his identity to Moses, you know, it's amazing how awesome God is, not just because he is a protector and he is a provider, but it's because he is relational. And we see that in verses 7 through 15. It says here that he listens to us. In verse 7, he says, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt. You know, he says he notices what is going on, what is the situation going on at this time. And he's telling Moses, I know what's going on. And I know that what you are going through is going to be extremely hard. And I hear you, Moses. I hear the nation of Israel. I know you guys are going through it right now. And I'm here to listen. I am here for you. You know, and I think that's encouraging to us today, that we can have a relationship with this God, with Yahweh, because he listens to us. He wants us to be a part of him. You know, we can directly communicate to him through prayer and through everything that we do. We can just talk to him. He is always there to pick up the phone. Another thing about God being relational and why he is different from these other gods is that he feels our pain. It says here at the end of verse 7, just before verse 8, it says, I know their sufferings. God understands the pain that his people are going through. And he understands the pain that we go through in our lives, whether it be depression, whether it be hardship, whether it be the loss of a job, whether it's something that happened at school or whatever that may be. You know, he feels our pain. Now, sometimes, do we deserve those things? Maybe on one circumstance. But however, you know, when we give our requests to him, he feels our pain. He wants to comfort us. He wants to love us. And it is so amazing that we have a God that is different from any of these other gods that Egypt is trying to promote to their nation and maybe even to Israel, because God feels our pain and he listens to us and he wants to deliver us. Then the next thing is that he is near us. In verse 12, it says, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. You know, we think about God, sometimes we almost, I guess in a way, someone like me, I always tend to think God is so big and so powerful and so mighty that he doesn't have time for me. Well, that's not true at all. It says here in verse 12 that I will be with you. He is always with us. He wants to be there for us. He wants to hear how our day is going. He wants to be a part of our lives. And he wants us to be dependent on him. You know, I don't know of any other God in this world that can do that, that wants to be with us, that wants to feel our pain, and that wants to listen to us. And then the last thing, why God is so awesome because of his relationship, is that more than anything else, he is consistent. Verse 14, this is where God reveals himself to Moses. He says, I am who I am. We talked about the word in Hebrew, Yahweh. You know, and that word, Yahweh, means it means that it is unchanging. It is something that is consistent. You know, we have a God that is unchanging. And it is so amazing that we have a God that loves us all the time, that gives us grace all the time, that even answers our prayers, whether it's in the way that we want it to or not. He loves us all the time. He doesn't just wait for 1,500, you know, prayer requests, and then he finally answers that prayer. He doesn't just wait for us to do something all the time. You know, he doesn't just love one in every five people. No, he loves each and every one of us. That is consistency. According to sports terms, I think of someone like Stephen Curry, who's the greatest three-point basketball shooter of all time. He is someone that is so consistent with his shooting. Of course, he's injured right now, so that's a little bit of a different story. But, you know, he is someone that trains all the time, and he is consistent in how he works on his shot. And, you know, and why I talk about him is because he has... You know, he doesn't give up. He doesn't give up on working on how to get better. You know, and God, in a way, is the same way. He doesn't give up on me and you. He is consistent. He is unchanging. And it is so amazing that we do have a God that is close to us. He wants to be with us. He wants to feel our pain. And he wants to be consistent. He wants to love us every chance that we get. He always has open arms ready to love us. Now, if you would turn in your Bibles as we close, we'll be in 1 John chapter 4, verse 7 through 10. 1 John chapter 4, and verse 7 through 10. You know, we think about all of these qualities that God showed to Moses and the people of Israel in these verses. You know, Moses ultimately develops a relationship with God and eventually ends up becoming a mediator for Israel and God. He becomes the guy that helps save Israel out of captivity, but he also helps them through the wilderness. And he ultimately becomes an amazing leader that we can still look to and look for examples of today. And so I think about someone like Moses and his relationship with God. Obviously, with this scene with the burning bush, it was kind of rocky at first because Moses was very nervous. He was someone that had to get out of his comfort zone. You know, it took a lot of convincing for Moses to finally do what God wanted him to. But when Moses started to develop his trust in God, he ultimately ended up becoming that famous leader that we know of today. And so today, we also get a chance to have that relationship with God too. And that's because of Jesus. And in 1 John chapter 4, in verse 7 through 10, it says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God. And whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love. And this, the love of God, was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. In this love, not that we have loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins." John writes that Jesus came down to earth so that we could have a relationship with God. And we see in the Gospel of John that Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." You know, Jesus here is the ultimate example of love, and he is the ultimate example of having a relationship with God and what that looks like in the human flesh. Jesus always made time for God, but he also made time for others. He was consistent in how he loved others. He listened to others. He felt someone's pain. He understood the pain of losing someone. And I know God feels that same pain when people turn away from him and they turn to these lowercase g gods, or they turn to the world and what the world has to offer them. You know, and I think about those who are in this building, who have trusted in God and have put Jesus as their Lord. You know, we see the consistency because of that. You know, that doesn't mean we're perfect by any means, but, you know, because of God's grace and because of his open arms and because of his consistency and because of his relationship with us, He always loves us, and because of that, we can have that relationship with him, and it's because of Jesus dying on the cross for our sins. You know, we need God in our lives, and we need a God to worship because we can't do life alone. And you know, God wrote in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14, the author said, "I am who I am," showing that he is consistent. And because he is consistent, we can have an opportunity to be a part of something bigger than ourselves, just like Moses. Moses was a part of a plan that was greater than he had ever realized. And we have a chance to be a part of that. That is his kingdom today. You know, he wants us to be dependent on him. And so if there's those of you that may be thinking about how do I grow a deeper relationship with God, Well, it takes a coming to Jesus moment. It comes to realize that either I have fallen short, or I have recognized that I have sin in my life. And so if you haven't put Jesus on in baptism and would like to take the next step in that relationship, you know, we would like to talk to you more about it. Maybe get a study in as well. If you have put Jesus on in baptism, but yet you have been struggling maybe with some things in your life, and you just want to come back to God, he is here for you. He is here to have open arms ready to welcome you back. Whatever it is that you need, come forward together as we stand and sing.